This is the Outrider Podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've been over my mess for a while. I've been taking it easy. Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I'm one of those paranoid souls that puts the thing over the camera.
Oh,
the,
wow. Nice. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't want anybody spying on me when I'm looking at porn, right? Like the deep state's really concerned about what I whack it to, right? I
mean, right.
Okay, I already hit record, so most of this stuff will probably go out unless we want to keep it for shits and giggles, just to let people know we're human. But yeah, really things you want to admit to online. Anyway, so what I thought I'd do is I'd read this little piece kind of like to set the stage, end up with a bunch of questions specifically pointing you at that Chomsky piece, and then we'll go from there and see how the conversation goes. If this one doesn't work, then maybe we'll go back to the old shop talk format and just decide we're going to do some points and yeah, go with that. Because, you know, whatever. If we, you know, maybe if we just consistently amuse ourselves, we'll eventually amuse other people. Maybe.
I'm trying.
Okay. So here we go. I'll get started on this. It's sort of longish, but not that long. When I started thinking about reviving the Outrider podcast, there were a few things I knew I needed to do first. First, I needed to keep from relying on interviews. I don't travel much, and except for the writers who travel to Wichita to read at Watermark Books, not many writers live in the area. The first incarnation of the Outrider podcast pretty much ran through every writer I know or had a loose connection with and whose work I was interested in. And although a book publicist friend was getting me in touch with new writers to talk to, I was not managing my time in the best possible way so that I could write, read according to my own interests, and keep up with reading books by unknown writers with an eye towards chatting with them on the podcast. I simply don't have the connections or the time to do a podcast on par with Mark Maron's WTF or Brad Listy's Other People. If I were going to restart the Outrider podcast, I needed to do a different format, something that could be maintained despite my lack of contacts. That led me to the second thing I knew I needed. And I knew I wanted my friend Stephen McClurg, say hi, Stephen.
Hello.
To be involved. And Stephen's a great talker, and that means he's good at filling in when I'm at a loss for words or when I drop out trying to think of something to say. He's also much more well-read than I am and makes connections where I don't. I know doing this is yet one more thing on his already busy schedule, so I want everyone, including Stephen, to know how grateful I am for his time, and I hope I don't waste it. And finally, I knew we needed to plan or structure episodes more than we did with our old Shop Talk episodes. Episodes needed to be topical in some way, or at least focused, and interesting in some fashion to people besides the two of us, and still be a very real conversation and not a set of planned talking points. When we first discussed what was to become this episode, we thought we'd try to focus on art as resistance. Both of us are troubled by the current president's administration and their outright aggression toward immigrants, women, the poor, the old, the sick, and disturbed by its disregard for the environment, education, and the arts. I have been particularly struggling with the best way to use my talents or skills to aid or support this resistance to the misogynistic, selfish, white nationalist agenda that now seems to be directing the government. I'm not comfortable being a piggy bank for various organizations, no matter how much I believe in their causes. I have $77,000 in student loan debt, a creaky old car, and at 45 and having never been married, no support mechanism except what my paycheck affords. I feel hemmed in financially, so some kind of engaged activism is my best option. But aside from signing petitions, attending marches, phone banking, or canvassing during an election cycle, there doesn't seem to be much I can do that 1,000 other people can't do as well. I would be glad to volunteer, but I'm not really willing to phone bank or knock on strangers' doors. I would prefer to use what talents and skills I have, writing and editing, to help my causes, but those talents rarely seem to be needed by the ACLU or the NAACP or even, ironically enough, the Authors Guild. I am quite literally a nobody, even to the causes I support and the organizations I've joined. I am just a body and a piggy bank, no matter what I do. But that doesn't mean I can't act independently, and so I've been wondering how I could do that, and thought Stephen and I might have a good conversation about that topic. How do writers resist? Unfortunately for us, it proved to be too broad and too unfocused the first time we tried it. When we tried to talk about it a few weeks ago, the conversation faltered. Neither of us, despite our reading and despite the notes we shared, knew quite where to dig in or what to say. We ended up focusing on John Gardner's book On Moral Fiction and an article by Mary Gordon that seemed critical of Gardner's general premise. So for a while we thought we'd try to talk about the conflicts Gordon raised, but after more aimless wandering and an unexpected illness, we threw out that idea as well. Both of us, I think, realized that Gordon basically agreed with Gardner and that she was taking him to task for the writers she used as examples, especially the old white Western writers that Gardner in 1978 held up as the epitome of his brand of moral fiction. Furthermore, we didn't really disagree with Gardner or Gordon, which meant trying to fill in gaps or revise elements would have made for a rather short podcast. At one point, Stephen shared a link to Noam Chomsky's piece, or a piece about Chomsky that seemed to touch on some of what we had been kicking around, and I have to admit I've purposely refused to read it in the hope that Stephen will sum up Chomsky's piece as a means of starting off our conversation once I'm done rambling here. I then brought up something that I was noticing in some of the reading I've been doing, or rather trying to do, and that publisher-slash-bookseller ghetto referred to as literary reference. You'll find John Gardner's masterful works On Moral Fiction, The Art of Fiction, and On Becoming a Novelist. You'll also find books like The Storytelling Animal by Jonathan Gottschall and All Things Shining by Hubert Dreyfus and Sean Dorrance Kelly, and many other books like them where authors make various cases for the importance and centrality of story in human society. Gottschall makes a scientific case, drawing in neuroscience, psychology, and evolutionary biology, to argue that story is central to human development and social stability. Dreyfus and Kelly take a more humanistic and philosophical approach, marshaling logic and reason to make essentially the same case, that story is a practice studio for being human. However, like Mary Gordon in her 2005 essay on Gardner in The Atlantic, I also don't agree with Gardner's hard assertion that fiction creates models of right action. I've never found myself in a real-life situation and thought, what would Patrick from Mondace's In the Skin of the Lion do? Or, having read some of Ian Fleming's Bond novels, what would James Bond do? To make the point a little more ridiculously. No, what fiction does, I think, what stories of all kinds can do, is provide that space to test actions and their consequences, not to give us a model to follow, but to give us a kind of foresight, or as fiction writers might say, a bit of imaginative foreshadowing. In other words, we read to find out what we imagine we ourselves would do if we were confronted with a cheating spouse or a dying child, without actually doing those things in real life and suffering the consequences. This slight shift is, to me, the only way to explain those well-read people who do evil. And, unironically enough, the only way to understand them is by reading. So, to me, there is something missing in Gardner's book and Gordon's essay, and the scientific and philosophical approaches that Gottschall, Dreyfus, and Kelly have put forward. And that's the work of Joseph Campbell. Campbell is not listed in the bibliographies of any of those books, which, considering Campbell's extensive work in comparative mythology, seems to me like an oversight. A lot of times, I think Campbell gets dismissed as a bit of a sensitive New Age fluff due to the ubiquitous nature of his most famous phrase, "Follow your bliss." And if he's not dismissed for that, then his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, is mentioned in passing along with some dismissive comment about the monomyth and then ignored, kind of a, yeah, yeah, all stories are the same, yada, yada type of response. And yet, if we're looking for ways to explain how storytelling and stories are important to the course of human development, both its high points and low points, and how stories provide us a practice space for moral decision-making and for coping with the challenges and inevitabilities of life, then Campbell would be the foundational starting point for any such argument. Pad your argument with science like Gottschall or philosophy like Dreyfus and Kelly, but start with Campbell. Start with taking a look at the stories, the myths our human ancestors told themselves, and see how those myths grew to define a society, and then how they withered and succumbed to other myths that seemed to move a society or culture forward, or even backwards. Take that great scope of time that we've been telling ourselves stories, from the earliest cave paintings and carved goddess figurines to our current TV shows, and it should become obvious, strikingly and undeniably so, that the stories we tell ourselves are of vital importance not just to our personal lives, but to the ultimate course of our civilization. In his book Present Shock, Douglas Rushkoff breaks down five distinct reactions to our current always-on culture. In the face of our 24-hour news cycles, our intrusive social media apps, our mind-numbing reality TV, people are first and foremost suffering from Rushkoff's primary ailment, narrative collapse, or an inability to construct a coherent story about how we got from, say, 1970 to 2017. For a species that has evolved as a storyteller, this is, first of all, troubling, but it's also how we get to the other four reactions Rushkoff writes about, things like digiphrenia and fractal noia. And if you haven't read the book, I recommend it highly, primarily because any summation I give would be spotty, and you really should get in the habit of checking source material. The point being, we, as storytelling animals, are in a period of trouble. Having not so much lost our ability to tell stories, but rather lost our ability to discern a sound and true story from a meaningless and false story, we seem now to be trapped in a zero-sum game of soundbite propaganda. And what we need is to regain our native ability to construct sound narratives, to weed out falsehoods, and construct a story that will move us into a kind of new stability. To me, it seems our professional storytellers, novelists, screenwriters, showrunners, comic book artists, graphic novelists, and poets, are the ones best equipped to this particular vein of the fight, since we kind of got here because of books like Atlas Shrugged. But this isn't a simple matter of finding or telling stories to supplant the popularity of Ayn Rand among the oligarchs and plutocrats and the people who love them, but telling stories that give the hoi polloi, the proletariat, something they can rally behind and use to carve out their own narrative of resistance. And this, I think, is where Chomsky comes in, right? If we're going to be heard, don't we have to understand the story we're up against and how that story is fed to us? Or am I off the mark? How does Chomsky fit in with our discussion so far about moral fiction, art, and resistance, and narrative collapse? What do I need to know, Stephen, about Chomsky and manufacturing consent?
Well, those are good questions. I don't know how many of those I can answer. That's a nice piece, by the way. It was a nice to hear kind of, you know, a kind of like we've been talking about a lot of this material right. For the course of several months. So it's nice to hear it be summed up in some way that kind of connects
right.
So many of those ideas. And particularly there towards the end, I think you said, I mean, basically what Gardner's point is, it was there towards the end. The idea, like when you mentioned screenwriters and writers, that was his whole thing with that book, is that, you know, coming back to, I guess when one way telling stories that matter, and in a second way, being able to judge stories that matter.
Right.
His symbol of Thor's hammer, and the idea of the two sides, one being the construction, and one being the critical side of it.
Yeah. That's where I think Gordon might have overread Gardner in some ways, just because, you know, he does tend to be a bit strident and a bit didactic on moral fiction about what is good and what is right, and not really that clear or that strong about the fact that it's not religion creating, it's role playing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I said in the piece, it's kind of the only way you can explain how, you know, somebody that reads a lot can end up being evil. They've gone into the role playing environment of fiction and made bad decisions.
that's like the image of, isn't it, what's his name, Alex in Clockwork Orange?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the name of the Alec or Alex, something like that, with the lead character? It's
been 20 years since I read Clockwork.
Yeah. Well, just that image, right? Someone like a misread. Mm-hmm. Like when he sits down and I think he's in one of the institutions and they give him the Bible, and like his image of it is like the Roman, you know, I think this is depicted in the film as well, is where he sits down to read the Bible, and for them they're like, you know, here, read something moral.
Right.
And he's like, this is fantastic. And he's, you know, thinking of himself as the Roman soldier whipping Christ up the hill, you know.
Right.
He's,
right.
He's reading it, you know, misreading it to some extent.
Right. Yeah, there's not much. We can write all the, we can have all the grandest intentions with what we write. But, you know, that's the other half of it, is the reader. And, you know, there's not much you can do with that, really. So I took a bit of a gander. I didn't completely ignore the Chomsky that mm-hmm. you sent over. But I guess what I'm concerned about is all of that intention we have, and that disconnect between what we intend and what the reader comes up with. What stands in the middle of that is the media, right? Is this monster that Chomsky's talking about?
And there's almost an easier way, I think, to discuss it. That's Rushkoff. Mm-hmm. You mentioned him. In a program, he does almost the same thing, but pointed towards MTV, sort of like MTV generation. It's called The Merchants of Cool.
Uh-huh.
It's about marketers and everything, and it's basically the same model without all of the vocabulary going for these different steps. And so, is it okay if I talk about that one in relationship to the Chomsky model? This, you know, Rushkoff probably used manufacturing consent in some way to work out some of the stuff that he does in there. And this used to be a free documentary. I think it came out around 2000 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So it's older, but the idea of it's pretty interesting is he starts in the opening with, what are they called? The, Insane Clown Posse.
Okay.
He looks at the Insane Clown Posse, and this is before, you know, they were as huge as they became, but
right.
And that was his point, is this was an underground band. He was like, here is an underground band. Their fans were ravenous. And so what marketers were doing was they were going to like skate parks, and they're mm-hmm. going to like, as Chomsky refers to, I'm sure other people have, like fringe, you know, borders,
right,
where that kind of stuff is kind of being created and being talked about, discussed, and you know, kids who have some sort of access to like skate magazines and then like mail order record labels, you know, independent labels and all that time. So marketers will go out and they'll take pictures of like, what are these kids wearing at skate parks and stuff. And they'll ask them sometimes, hey, can we go to your house? And like, they'll pay them a certain amount of money to take pictures of like what posters they have in the room and stuff.
Right.
So he starts with that and then he starts with wrestling, and wrestling, I'm trying to think of what the plot line with the wrestling is, but I guess I want to say at the time, like wrestling was like dominated TV, whatever. Like right. It was one of the biggest, productions, entertainment.
Professional wrestling, like Hulk Hogan and all that stuff. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I don't know if it was WWE at the time or WWF, but it was whatever the WWF became.
Right. Right.
So like Undertaker and all those huge, the big names, you know, the huge ones.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, I think he does do some of the backyard wrestling people who are trying to get into it, mm-hmm. but it's been a little while, but, and then he, one of the other things he's looking at is spring break and right. how spring break operates. And the feedback loop, in a way, which is like the idea of manufacturing consent in a certain way. This is more like manufacturing rebellion.
Uh-huh.
So MTV films kids at spring break and then films their own stuff. And then that gets filtered back through the culture, who then behaves the way that they saw the people behave on the thing,
right.
because that's what you do at spring break, and it just escalates.
Right.
And so he calls that this like media feedback loop, mm-hmm. where people are filmed and then other people look to see how they're supposed to react. I mean, you can see this on like reality TV, right?
Right.
Like years, like a decade or so, even years later, where there are types on the reality show where you're supposed to act like this, you're supposed to react to this, you're supposed to say, throw me under the bus, you're supposed to right. use certain terminology in all of that and become a certain type of character.
It all started with the real world.
Yeah. MTV. There you go. Yeah. Again, MTV. So he follows, it's interesting. He follows Insane Clown Posse. So when they start, they're seen as rebellion, as this rebellious thing. And, they'll never be on the radio. Their fans are like, they'll never have a video. They'll never be on the radio. They'll never be popular. And what happens is, over the course of them making the documentary, is by the end of it, Insane Clown Posse are on the radio. It
right.
goes through all the stuff with, I can't remember the name. They got caught, you know, it just, if you're on a major label, that you get paid to be played on the radio, and someone
right.
got, I mean, that's how it goes. I mean, that's what it is. But, was it Fred Durst band, Limp Bizkit, I guess, got caught and
right.
Yeah. But anyway, ICP ended up on the radio. They ended up making videos. They were on MTV. They became a huge, you know, group. And then at the end, you know, they were on wrestling. They were on WWE, you know, in front of like the largest audience, entertainment had at the time. So,
right.
So I guess that idea, to transfer that over to Chomsky, the idea is that the idea of manufacturing consent is that all of that stuff is kind of prefigured in the model. And, you know, you do have stuff that gets ejected out to the fringes, but because it gets ejected out to the fringes, it's either not taken seriously or it wasn't serious to begin with and all that kind of stuff. Does that make sense in some way? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of, to me, that seems like it's the first hurdle we have to get past. As you were talking about that, you know, that feedback loop and how they do that stuff, and if it was happening in the late 90s, what I find interesting, that to counterbalance that is kind of the angsty media thing that was going on in the late 80s and early 90s over Generation X. The mm-hmm. fact that we didn't respond to advertising. You know, that they didn't quite know how to market to my generation.
Well,
you know,
well, then you start marketing, you know, designer flannels, I guess.
Right. But that, you know, that, you know, they made a shot at it with, you know, with they made attempts at it, but we never really seemed to fall for it. Mm-hmm. You know, that whole slacker mentality is, you know, go do this. We just kind of went to everything.
Yeah.
And I think we still do. It's kind of funny. The people that, to me, I've always thought that the people who, of our generation, the people born, you know, in that window from, say, like 67 to 78, you know, mm-hmm. around in that area, those of us who were all in high school and college at about the same time between like 88 and 94 or 95, you know, that were in high school and college during that time. The people who did end up going into politics were the ones who could be marketed to.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay, I see it, yeah.
And oddly enough, they're the ones who are conformist and conservative and just evil bastards.
Yeah.
And... You know, and to me, because yeah, I look at people like Paul Ryan and stuff like that, and what I see are those weird fundamentalist religious high school kids that were involved in student council and like, you know, leading the cheer squad and doing whatever. It's like, and everybody else was kind of like meh. And to me, that seems that's slacktivism, I guess, which gets bandied around a lot. There's been a lot of there was even a blog for a while. I think it's still going, called The Slacktivist.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, you let the narrative happen outside of you, but because of that, we are in a position where those of us that are actually decent human beings aren't in control. So I guess what I'm kind of wondering is, you know, is how do we have to do something, you know, we have to tell some different story. We have to tell some other kind of narrative. And we have to break that spell that marketing and manufactured consent perhaps and things like that have over people. And we have to do it in such a way that when the media co-opts it, you know, to sell it back to us,
mm-hmm.
it defies corruption.
Yeah.
Have I made too much of an impossible task? Is that something that you can't do with the story, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. It's... like I said, for me, I've had to come to my own conclusions on that, and that they're just separate things for me. Mm-hmm. I do a certain kind of work one way, that I hope is directly benefiting people and working towards that.
Which is?
Well, teaching and all of the, everything that goes along with it. You know, it's not just talking about story. It's working with lots of people and working with lots of young people and mm-hmm. Not telling them what or how to think, but maybe how to think better, more critically of things and of things that they're interested in, helping them to find their own interests. It's one thing that has been always interesting to me mm-hmm. since I started teaching is I have so many students who often can't express what just simply interests them.
Right.
Like, what are you interested in? And it's like, well, I like, you know, TV and I like movies. And like, well, what kind of movies do you like? Well, why do you, you know, and it, like stuff like that, you know, it's,
right.
I had a student this week and it's really like the best thing I can hope to do He came back. He's, I think it's his senior year in college, and he's a history major, and he's going to go into education. Mm-hmm. And he said, this was the best class that I took. It was my 101, 102 class. He's like, this is the best class that I took to get ready for college.
Right.
He was like, it was the type of thinking I needed to learn how to do. We were reading good material, doing the writing that, like helping me get my thoughts down on paper and write right. and all that. And I was like, oh, that's all you know, good. That's the best I can hope to do. Right. You know, he's,
so that felt good, right?
yeah. It doesn't happen often, so it is nice when it does happen, because really you're just in the trenches when you're with the current group, because mm-hmm. they're thinking about spring break and the prom and this and that, and you're just trying to hope that something that you're doing in the class matters.
Right.
To them, and that you can help with that, whatever it is that they're interested in, that they can think about it more easily or express themselves more easily, or at least to the ability that they'll need to for whatever their future works and interests are, you know, whether it's writing or if it's, working in business somewhere or whatever right. it is. And so that and before that I had done volunteering. And I had tutored, and with the amount of time having my own kids that teaching takes up today, I don't do that stuff, but I do, 8 to 9 hours at a school building, trying to do my best to help students. So
right.
that for me is what I do in terms of, that's how I feel in terms of resistance and all that, mm-hmm. but again, I'm not telling them what to think, however they want to think. I want them to be able to look at the sources and do that stuff for themselves.
Right.
And then the artistic stuff, like writing and all that, I just don't, it's not that I don't care about it, but I just right. don't direct my art towards that, you know?
Yeah.
I hope it seeps in. Like there's something with the Gardner idea of thinking through ideas and process, and that's beneficial in some way, or we hope to
right.
hope it is.
Right. No, because I understand what you're saying, because if you do sit down to write with some kind of idea of resistance, then you do really run that risk of ending up being didactic and dogmatic and making mistakes as an artist. Whereas, as Gardner said, is using fiction as a thought process. The writer is the first person that's kind of experimenting with the situational problem. What do I do? What would I do if I were confronted with this, event and situation? And we tell a story and we, smack on it like with a tuning fork to make sure that it's sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put it out in the world and hope that other people, think that it rings true as well. And of course that doesn't mean someone isn't going to completely misinterpret it, but it's role playing, it's experimentation, it's not preaching. And if you set out to preach in fiction, you're going to corrupt the message. I guess it goes back to what Gardner was saying, is you don't write to tell people what to think or believe. You write to mm-hmm. figure out what you should think and believe.
Yeah, his definitions, like moral is life-giving. Moral does not, means not too blatantly immoral. Like
right.
Moral does not equal didacticism. And the stuff then that he says it is unselfish, helpful, kind, noble-hearted.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose you hope that you build, like you said, that true, and he refers to it as true art. So he
right.
has that kind of truth, that very old idea of truth, beauty, and good, mm-hmm. goodness there. And yeah, I mean, you hope.
Yeah, because, at one point Gardner was talking, what was he, the phrase was, I think I had it on a note down here somewhere. It was, oh, well, crap. thought I had put a note in it somewhere, and I didn't. What was it? It bordered on what I want to say is it's not exactly moral relativity, but it's this idea that good is relative to the era or the time.
Towards the whole, the end of the, it's one of those last few chapters, his whole thing. And that's one of the things that, is it Gordon, the other writer that we were looking at? It's something that it seems like, I don't know, she may just doesn't jive with her, or she didn't look at that part enough, is that he says that we find this for our own time.
Right.
I think it's towards the end there in that like chapter 3 or something, or it's late in the book.
This is sort of related to it. Real art creates myths a society can live instead of die by. And that kind of, it's comments like that that always make me wonder, well, where the fuck is Campbell in all of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? That's true.
Because if you take a look at Campbell, you kind of have to take away some of Gardner's absolutism, because you see, as Campbell writes about the progression and the evolution of mythologies in certain regions of the world, how a society that had a mythic structure that was orchestrated around regicide, killing the king every 4 years and going into this ritual of burying him in a mound and waiting for an ant to come out of a tube and all this other stuff like that, and then how that evolved into more ritualistic forms of regicide, where they didn't actually kill the king every 4 years, but they did this ceremony that, and how that grew over time and evolved into different things. And you can see that nothing that Gardner says is absolute is really that rigid. We tell a story that creates a stable society, a stable way of functioning, and something comes along and disrupts it. It becomes stagnant. It becomes destructive of itself, and then it changes. It's not necessarily progress, but it's. I think sometimes we make the mistake of confusing the words progress and evolution as being synonymous, and they're not.
Mm-mm.
So, the culture and society evolves, and the what was a requirement in one era of a civilization is now a ritual in the next iteration of it. And
which I think is why the Gordon, some of the arguments that she had about it was, I hope I'm not misrepresenting her, so let me know if I am. But it seemed like she fell back on Gardner as trying to be, the kind of crusty canonist because of the examples that he put in the book. But then when she gave her own examples for it, they were examples that Gardner said weren't. Like he did not back pound as someone for this. He didn't even back Hemingway for it.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't as hard on Hemingway as he was on Pound, and those were the two examples that I remember her mentioning. And it was like, well, those were his counterexamples to what he's looking for.
Right.
And I think part of it was he felt that most people at the time he was writing this, late 70s, had just abandoned those principles in terms of story, of that truth, of that beauty, of that goodness.
Right, right.
For what he calls texture.
Yeah.
At least in that book.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because it's there was some definite, I think there was some misreading on the part of Gordon in that Atlantic piece. But I think there's in general a lot of misreading and even some, for all of Gardner's intelligence and knowledge about it, I think there were some things he really did miss because he didn't go places he could have gone.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with all these people now that are shoving people in MRI machines and seeing how their brains react to story. And it's like, okay, so you've got this mechanical, oddity, and you're trying to explain it, and without the MRI machine, Campbell explained it. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's like the digital humanities, how many times did James Joyce use the word of, we can.
Right. What does that add to it? That,
I mean, I'm sure there's some words, you know, and things like that. I haven't looked at all the digital humanity stuff, but some of it to me just seems like,
yeah, okay. It seems kind of like a, you know how there was a trend, and it's probably still exists. I just have kind of cut it out of my life in certain ways, of religious people attempting to use the scientific method to prove stories in the Bible.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, no, you know, you can, and the thing about art and the humanities,
Shroud of Turin, Noah's Ark, there's a lot of,
right. And, you know, there, one of my favorite ones was, I got into a conversation with a friend who was, you know, there was this, I don't remember what the book was or the writer of it, but he was, you know, attempting to use, you know, logic, you know, philosophy and logic to prove the existence of God. And it's like, no, there's still this fundamental leap of faith that needs to be had for any of that, you know, logic, you know, to be accepted as saying, yes, there is a deity.
Mm-hmm. I like the way that the ancient aliens, the way they handle the ancient alien folks.
Right.
How they handle that, where they want to come at everything in terms of logic and science, mm-hmm. but they take the story as is, literally. So it's like, well, there were angels.
Right.
They were these beings that seemed to have powers that humans didn't, and they may have had wings and spaceships. They were aliens. When manna fell from the skies, it was an alien machine that delivered bread. That's one of my favorites. The manna. Someone built a manna or diagrammed a manna machine. Like, this is the spaceship, the manna machine, the bread deliverer that distributed food out to the people in the desert.
Right.
I think it's when the Jews are in exile. Not just thinking that that is maybe a metaphor.
Right.
That this is symbolic, but that they take the story as literal, mm-hmm. and then attempt to use science and logic to figure out how it could have happened.
Right.
It's an amazing,
yeah,
just bizarre use of logic that I love. I love those shows. Well,
it's massively inventive and creative,
but it's like Occam's razor. You guys heard of that in science or religion? Like, you don't have to put an alien in there to make that story work.
But it also echoes some of the stuff that our friend Rushkoff was talking about in Present Shock. You know, when he talks about things like fractal noia and things like that, where, you know, because we've had this kind of, you know, societal narrative collapse, and we as storytelling animals have this need to fit ourselves and culture into some kind of narrative. And when things begin, when the real thing begins to fracture and no longer makes sense, we fill that in with massive amounts of creativity. And that's where you get, you know, all these weird conspiracy theories and aliens, you know, ancient alien astronauts, you know, and all the stuff to fill in it, because people need somehow to fit themselves into a system that seems in some way to be logical and rational and to explain the mysteries that they can't otherwise get their brains around. I find it both fascinating and sad, because I am perfectly comfortable with mystery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, but we're ambiguity and things like that. I think that's part of whatever that is in terms of writing or creating. I think that's maybe not for everybody, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Spielberg really, you know, enjoys ambiguity or anything. It doesn't really seem to, based on his work. Or he's just a better commercial artist, and that he understands that most people
don't like ambiguity.
And I'm speaking as a teacher, like, those are those moments, that strangeness in the thing where I can't say, well, it could be, you know, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
It draws me in, and I like it and enjoy it and chew on it and digest it. And I enjoy that. Now I enjoy the other stuff too. A Francis Bacon essay, mm-hmm. or, you know, something that is just either beautiful or logical or both.
Right.
I enjoy that too, but I think as a, and we both, you know, you read poetry too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. You,
those,
so
if you're, my favorite,
if you read,
my
if
favorite
you read poetry,
quote from
you can, oh, go ahead. No,
no, every no, there was a conversation that Terry Gross had on NPR and Fresh Air one time with a poet who'd written a book. I can't remember his name or the book, but I remember this line he had, which was, he said, "Those who don't read poetry aren't fit to be let loose in the world."
Yeah, it's you know, teaching it and then also, you know, attempting to write it and just enjoying poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's even like when we use that as a metaphor when we talk about certain types of films, or we, you know, I think part of what that means seems to me is that kind of the mysterious, mm-hmm. the, it could be religious or it could be mystical. It could be,
right,
you know, just a certain slant of light, you know, I mean, it doesn't
right.
have to, it's that image and all of that, that image can evoke from emotion to times. I mean, it's just, that's that mystery in it. Is just to me like it's that beauty in it and that ability to wander and to I almost wanted to say revelate, but that's weird, but it to some degree right
sense.
You know,
yeah.
and to be able to be within that and to be in that, allow that to kind of wash over you or to allow that image to hold and to think about it and then move on, that there doesn't have to be a beginning, middle, end, there doesn't have to be a story there, is part of the beauty of it. And then you can transfer that over and be comfortable. But people like narrative. I mean, in general,
well,
people
yeah.
like narrative. And they, so, but you, as a reader of poetry, you're already in a minority. And as someone who writes, you know what I mean? So I think like you saying that
right.
you like mystery is, it doesn't have to be, I guess, but it seems like that's in some way connected to your, you know, like doing this kind of work, mm-hmm. I think. I don't know. That's been my interest. My experience in the classroom is students really, most people don't like that.
Right. Well, I guess part of the reason, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said, but I also, maybe I just, because I have a wildly expansive view of story and plot, but, you know, even a poem that doesn't seem to, you know, have a narrative to it, to me is still, in a way, telling a story. It's the story of this moment of experience. So yeah, it doesn't have the traditional, you know, Freytag's triangle of a narrative to it, but it is that author's story of this moment of their consciousness. Does that make sense?
I think I think of moments, and I guess for me, I process those as images. But
right.
the image is, but it, like, in that image, there are doors and windows and
exactly.
potential. I guess it's more, for me, I see it as maybe all these potentialities for
uh-huh.
story. I mean,
right.
I don't, like, it's open. Like it.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Is that, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're saying the same thing. But
yeah, we're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
It's, I don't, to me, you know, that was one of the things we had this discussion when I was in graduate school, you know, what is story? And, you know, that everybody would come up with, you know, these weird analogies. The most popular one was, you know, you have a character and you chase them up a tree and surround it with vicious dogs. And the story is, how do they get down?
Yeah.
Right. And my thing was kind of, I get this thing for puns from my dad, but I guess they're not really puns in that way. I mean, one of his things he was incredibly happy about was in the early 80s when Ford came out with the Taurus car.
Mm-hmm.
He says, now they're going to come out with a Featherus so they can Taurus and Featherus. And
nice.
And so when they were having this conversation in graduate school about, you know, all these different things that make up story and this has to happen or this happens and you do this, whatever. And my response was, well, you know, plot happens, kind of like shit happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I always thought you could have a story, you could have a plot, intricate, where the two people physically don't do anything but sit in a room and stare at each other.
That's, yeah, I don't.
And it depends on how you structure that tension, what they are mm-hmm. trying, what, if you're able to get at what each character wants from that silence, then you can create a tension, you can create a plot, and they will do nothing but sit and stare at each other.
Well, we, you know, did. like speaking like towards that, I like thinking of story, thinking of plot, and I guess I kind of think of them as two different things too, right? You were saying you kind of think of them as two different things,
right?
Like you can, it's not interesting always to analyze plot, mm-hmm. especially like if you're gonna think of images as these moments, and then you know it's like, you know, that guy sat at his kitchen table, like in terms of a plot,
right?
That's it. Like Story of an Hour is one that we went over this week, and I was like, so, you know, in terms of plot, in terms of a series of actions, or even a better one, Hills Like White Elephants,
right?
In terms of plot and a series of actions,
yeah, there's not much there.
He gets up from the table and goes to the bar, sets the bags down, I think, and comes back. That's like literally, right. In terms of plot, it. They, you know, I mean, I guess you could say, well, the waitress brings them beers, they drink beers, but still,
right?
Not interesting in terms of just a plot. But what we were talking about in the class, and what I wanted them to see, is that structure in relationship to the content is really interesting, and mm-hmm. is that they are stuck. They are stuck in a spot in their relationship.
Right.
And then the opening with the description of the setting, you find out like it's so hot. Mm-hmm. They have these bug screens up. It's right. uncomfortable. Like the whole setting is making you uncomfortable. And then they are at this moment of they're stuck in a relationship. And so right. they're kind of like the story. They're stuck between these two rails.
Yep.
In this bar/train station. And it's, to me, like all of that then is perfect. I don't need a lot of action. I don't mm-hmm. need all that stuff. But yeah, it's kind of funny. Like in terms of plot, like
not much there.
So it's not, you know. But as a story, as it works and plays out, it's like it's fantastic. I think.
Right.
And it's a really cool use of it's a non-traditional what we think of the plot, mm-hmm. the Freytag's triangle. Or right. pyramid, or however you want to say it. An interesting way where you have those elements, you do get some exposition throughout, but it's, again, it doesn't just happen at the beginning.
Right.
And, you know, you can mark, well, here's the scenes of action, like here's what they do, literally. But that, the structure and the content fit together so well, mm-hmm. like being, well, frozen in a really hot place, you know, stuck, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They're stuck in a train station. They're stuck in their relationship. They're mm-hmm. it's uncomfortable in the train station, and they've got this uncomfortable, you know, knowledge between them about her situation. And
yeah.
What do you do? What do you do with that? How do you deal with that? That's that kind of, you know, and that goes back to, I think, what it goes, it, you know, it, you don't read that
too.
Story and go, what would that, you don't find yourself in a similar situation and go, what would that character do? And what would that character do? Because, you know, both of those characters are not really examples of good behavior.
That's not,
but
we don't have the hero, the heroes. There is no action because there is no hero in that story.
Right.
It doesn't.
But when you do find yourself in a stagnant relationship with an unwanted pregnancy, you have had because as the scientists and the neurologists say, because your brain doesn't know the difference between a memory and a story that it's been told. It goes into the same mm-hmm. spots of the brain. So when you find yourself in that in a situation similar to that, you don't ask yourself, well, what was the main character? I don't think the characters had names.
I don't think the characters have names in that.
You could say
Adams.
Yeah, what does Nick Adams do in Hills Like White Elephants? No, you don't ask that. But what you do have is this experience in your brain of that pain and that struggle. And you relate that to your own self, and you're like, well, how do I want to resolve that? How do I want to come to terms with that? And because of this empathetic transference, you know what would feel right, what would feel wrong, and you have an idea of what the other person might be experiencing in that same situation. And that can affect the way you act. Yes, it can also, you can also act cruelly and viciously, but you can also act more nobly than that character did. Does that make sense? I mean, is that
mm-hmm. yeah. kind of... No, that's...
That's kind of the importance of story to me when it's done right.
When I talk to, when we first get into poems with juniors, I talk to them about Terrence, This Is Stupid Stuff. Have you read that?
No.
Oh, I'll send it to you. Okay. And we talk about it. And I tell them, you know, like, you know, if you end up liking this stuff, that's great. You don't have to. But here are some things that even like Gatsby can tell us in that. And part of it, whenever we look at poems, especially at that age, what I tell them is like, bring it up to now. What can it tell us now? Because all of these, whether it's called The Butterfly, whether it's called The Tractor and the Heap, whether it's called this, they're all about being human, not all about living in the world.
Right.
So what does this, what do they tell us about that? And the one that I go through with them, talk a little bit with them about is Terrence, This Is Stupid Stuff by A.E. Housman. Mm-hmm. And the opening of it, it starts as like a, it opens with a friend of Terrence's. Terrence is a poet. And the first couple of lines are like, Terrence, this is stupid stuff. You eat your vittles fast enough. And he says, you know, you drink your beer, you seem okay. Like, why do you write all these sad poems? Like, what is your problem? Like, why do you do that? And then, it's an older poem by A.E. Housman. Then Terrence gives his answer and part of his answer builds into like what you're saying. It's like towards the end, he talks about Mithridates, the king who, takes on poisons.
Right.
And every time one of his enemies tries to poison him, he lives through it. And so he equates to like the experience of like either sadness or anger or hatred or like these things, or feeling alone, you know, feeling alone in the world, is this stupid stuff can let someone else know that someone else has been lonely and therefore they're not alone in their loneliness, or they're, you know, something like that. I don't know if it helps, but
no, I think it does.
It makes me feel, I don't know if it helps my students, but it makes me feel better because I tell them like that was, you know, it was part of, you know, my own interestness is that when you feel alone, knowing that other people often feel alone and that's not a unique thing, or it doesn't make you weird. It doesn't make you, you know, in that depression or whatever, other people have faced it. Well, how did they face it? What did they say about it? You know?
So I guess what my, to kind of wrap up here, my question is that, I guess would be, so yeah, your form of resistance or rebellion is outside of, or including your artwork is teaching. You have that avenue for it. So it's, you know, you're not just, a piggy bank for the causes, or, you know, you're not restricted to doing whatever.
I couldn't be. And like you said, I can't be. I mean, I'm not in the position.
Right. So as someone like me who doesn't have the avenue, the educational avenue, I'm not teaching anymore. I'm trapped in the corporate world, and of course I'm a slow writer. It takes me years to come up with a manuscript. Mm-hmm. Should I like take to leaving really good books on park benches as a form of resistance? Should I select reading lists and send them to my conservative, weird right-wingy family and you know, wean them off Sean Hannity with, you know, Paradise Lost. I mean, you know,
I don't think Gardner would approve. He didn't seem to like, Milton very much. He took several jabs at Milton.
Right.
I mean, for me, the answer, I guess I always come back to that notion, and it's maybe just a flawed notion of, that I need to do that in some sort of, activity, I've done that with my own stuff, guerrilla
poetry.
Just like leaving stuff. I'll leave it in, when I used to make more zines and comics and stuff, I would often, when I finished a zine or something, would leave some at bookstores and in libraries and books I liked and just leave them there. Not that they were there to help anybody. Most people probably just went, oh, what is this? And threw it away. But uh, I, Yeah, that's one thing. I guess for me, like in that situation, what I did when I couldn't offer money and didn't do anything is I volunteered, and mostly I did a lot of English tutoring with Buddhist monks. Mm-hmm. And that was I did work for a few different. I would write for the college newspaper. Mm-hmm. Which was kind of nice because it paid, but I really mostly did like either reviews or kind of goofy pieces. And then I did work for an advocacy paper, and I would write articles. Like I wrote one on underground storage tanks, where gas stations had closed down. There were chemicals that were leaking out of them in several places. And so I went out and did interviews with people and then put together a piece and, I interviewed the DA or the assistant DA, I can't remember, in Mobile after they made hemp illegal at one point. This was late 90s, early 2000s. And luckily the DA was like, I know they passed this as a law, but I'm not prosecuting anyone with hemp. You know, he was just like, it's paper and bracelets and shirts and there's no THC in it. Like, so it was good, you know, it was interesting to talk to him about that. And he was just like, I doubt if anyone's going to get it. You know, he was just kind of, you know, surprised about the law as much as anyone else was. There was one where it was against a kind of religious freedom or something. I don't remember. It was the idea of, I can't remember how they had you were, but I did some work on the amount of criminals in jail for marijuana as mm-hmm. opposed to other things and stuff like that. And I did that for 5 or 6 years. And then I went to grad school. And then after that, you know, really since then, I've kind of been teaching. So I just don't have time for it.
Right.
Okay. I mean, those are the ways that for me, I think everyone, and that's another thing. I don't know if we've talked about it to each other, but like going through all this idea of like, I think that it's up to us individually to figure out, you know, well, one, do you care? And if the answer is yes, because I mean, for some people there isn't, and that's, you know, like all the John Zorn work, not that I don't want to speak for him and say he doesn't care, but he says in multiple places, you know, it's more of that true artist, kind of pure artist vision that he has. And he doesn't have an interest in, you know, popular culture as is, mm-hmm. and wasn't interested in either gaining or having the knowledge that, say, like one person that was brought up was like, say, Frank Zappa, in terms of Zappa's knowledge of politics and what's going on in politics. And he said he didn't want it. You know, he wanted to work on his own work.
Right.
And I guess what it comes down to is every person has to find the thing that is going to allow them to feel like they're doing their part, whatever mm-hmm. that is. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Hope I'm not rambling.
No, I think that's a good place to wrap this one up, and then we'll call it a quits. We'll call it a day, and then we'll launch from this one with the next episode that you'll lead off, like I did with this one, and we'll see how that format works. So thanks to everybody for listening, and
thank you.
We'll see you in a month, maybe. We'll see how this goes.